You're listening to Generation Squeeze's Hard Truths. I'm Megan Wilde. As you may have picked up, we're very excited about the Liberals' promise of fairness for every generation in the upcoming federal budget. But there's a big hurdle in their way. The same hurdle that any government or party trying to budget more fairly for all generations will have to confront. How do we pay for the soaring retirement costs of our aging loved ones without skimping on the needs of younger Canadians and burdening future generations with massive public debt? To dig into this gnarly question, Gen Squeeze founder Paul Kershaw spoke with leading conservative thinker Sean Spear. Sean is the Hub's editor-at-large, a public policy fellow at the University of Toronto, and former senior economic advisor to Prime Minister Stephen Harper.
So, Sean, welcome back to Hard Truths. We're really delighted to have you join us again. And can I say that I have become such a fan of The Hub and the leadership it is providing to political dialogue in Canada? And I wanted to sing your praise in being the editor at large there. Well done.
Yeah, it's very kind. It took too long, but we finally have Dr. Paul Kershaw's first essay at The Hub. We published a really thoughtful analysis applying an important intergenerational lens to provincial fiscal policymaking.
Well, I was keen for us to explore the possibility of that collaboration because last fall, following the fall economic statement from the federal government, I was really intrigued by some of your writing where you were alerting us all to the fact that Canada is now facing a fiscal reckoning. And if I'm paraphrasing you correctly, I loved it. You said, like, we can't sustain what you call Justin Trudeau's spending preferences on Stephen Harper's tax rates. I was hoping you could unpack that a little bit for me and for our listeners.
Yeah, I think it's fair to say, Paul, that, you know, that center of gravity of a lot of our political discussions is tilted to the left these days. And we're seeing renewed ambition on the role of government in the economy and society. The Trudeau government is been at the forefront of those developments. We've seen a pretty significant expansion of the federal government, both in terms of program spending, but also its employment footprint. You know, a lot of spending coming out of the pandemic that now appears permanent, including an enriched child tax credit, which maybe you like from an intergenerational point of view. But the point is, you know, we seem to be exiting a period in which ambition around the role of and the size of government had been limited really since, you know, sometime in the 1980s or 90s. The problem, it seems to me, is that that ambition on the spending side hasn't been matched by an accompanying conversation about the resources that we're bringing into government to discharge, you know, these increasing demands. Mm-hmm. There are states around the world, I think, for instance, of Denmark, which has made that political choice, that collective choice, that they're prepared to, on one hand, ask more of the government, but on the other hand, generate the tax revenue in order to cover those costs. And it seems to me for the past decade or so in Canada, we've been able to set those conversations aside in part because borrowing costs have been so low. You know, trade-offs disappear in a world of zero-cost capital, but in a world in which it's going to cost more and more to borrow, it seems to me we need to come to a collective judgment. Are we prepared to live within the tax revenues that we're paying now, or are we going to bring our tax revenues into an alignment with our spending demands? And you know, one way to sort of personify that question is right now we all seem prepared to pay Stephen Harper's tax rates, and yet we expect out of Ottawa Justin Trudeau's spending preferences. Mm-hmm.
I want to play with the clever way in which you're summarizing it, because is it really Justin Trudeau's spending preferences? I see Doug Ford, conservative government in Ontario, running a deficit outside of a recession. You know, I see David Eby, NDP government, running a deficit outside of a recession. That's our three parties. So this seems like a nonpartisan issue. This is not an ideological issue. It strikes me more and more that it is a structural issue, and that really, you know, the things that are growing fastest at the federal level, you mentioned the increase of the Canada Child Benefit, but that's pocket change. The $10 a day childcare is pocket change by comparison with the growth on old age security and medical care for the aging population. So is it really Trudeau's spending preferences, or is it more like boomer budgets on the back of their kids and grandchildren?
Yeah, there's something to that. I can't pass up a clever turn of phrase. but you're right that it's more complex than that, that this problem transcends order of government and, as you say, transcends partisanship. I mean, at its core, Canadians are saying yes to a dollar of government in exchange for 90 cents or whatever it turns out to be in terms of taxes. And, you know, I think you can do that for some time, but at some point you have to have a kind of adult conversation.
Yes.
About how to close that gap. And it either comes in the form of raising taxes in order to fulfill the demands that we're imposing on government, or adjusting those demands to bring them in line with what we want to pay for. And I would just say, before I turn it back to you, that's in a world, Paul, in which there are a lot of outstanding spending pressures facing policymakers at all orders of government. I think, for instance, of Prime Minister Trudeau's recent trip to Europe, where he was effectively scolded by other world leaders for the inadequacy of Canada's military spending. And I should emphasize, that's not a partisan observation. You know, we've had inadequate military spending for some time under successive prime ministers. He happens to sort of bore the brunt out of it this week. Mm-hmm. But to put it in some context, to get to 2% of GDP dedicated to our military, which would bring us in line with the NATO target, and still below, it must be said, a lot of our peers who've been ramping up spending even higher than that, would amount to something like $20 billion in annual incremental increase in spending. That amounts to about 2.5 percentage points on the GST. And that's in addition to all of the other things that we've been talking about and for which your listeners will be familiar, including pending pharmacare legislation and pressure on climate-related spending and on and on and on. So it seems to me, even before you start to apply an intergenerational lens to our fiscal policy, and I, as you know, I'm an enormous fan of the work that you're doing, and I think it is so important for various reasons. But even before you get there, I think we have kind of an arithmetic problem that our politicians have tried to solve through borrowing, but one gets a sense that that lever is no longer as reliable as it's been in the past several years, and something has to give.
I think that you're shining a light on a broader cultural problem that we have. And, you know, we can make it a sport or a pastime in our country to, you know, poke fun at our politicians of all party stripes. But to some degree, we get the politics that we deserve. And I worry that we've been heading into an election saying to leaders of all parties, offer me more, but don't talk to me about how we're going to pay for it. And so I want to push on that theme a little bit more with a political leader that you'll have better insight into than I do. And so I think about Mr. Polyev's success in the polls these days. And he uses a phrase that catches my attention every time he says it. And I think I get a little bit nervous. So I want to explore my nervousness with you. So he talks about inflationary deficit spending. And you can understand, outside of a recession, when we're running large deficits, you know, it's a good, smart, typical economic analysis, like, okay, you're just adding fuel to the inflationary fire. But over 80% of the federal deficit can be accounted for by growth in old age security and medical care for our aging loved ones. And Mr. Polyev talks about, like, hey, if I were prime minister, for every new dollar of spending, I would be cutting something. So here's my question. I'm very skeptical that he would think seriously about dramatic cuts to old age security or dramatic cuts to the Canada Health Transfer. So is it the case that he's not being briefed by folks who are letting him know that actually, you know, the deficit's not really all that, you know, what Justin Trudeau's doing? It's kind of this structural issue. And if and when you become prime minister, you know, a newsflash, you're going to inherit this big structural problem. I don't think he's like priming us to be ready for that. What do you think about my assessment?
Yeah, it's a great question, Paul. Let me try to respond in two ways. First, well, you're of course right that the circumstances that incoming Polyev government will face is not solely or even primarily the responsibility of the choice of the Trudeau government. It is still true that the Trudeau government has increased program spending. In its first 5 years prior to the pandemic, program spending grew on average by about 6.5% per year. To sort of put that in some context, in the final 5 years of the Harper government, it grew by about 0.5% per year. So the Trudeau government has made a series of choices that have, in a way, exacerbated some of the deeper structural factors that are driving up the demands on government that you mentioned, which brings me to my second point. late in January, I was honored to be asked to make a presentation to the Conservative Caucus leading into the return of Parliament on economic and fiscal issues. And one of the slides that I presented, the federal government is poised to remain in deficit for some time with spending growing at 3% per year, which is about half the growth that we saw under the Trudeau government in its first 5 years. As I say, one can debate whether those numbers are achievable or not. But what I said to the Conservatives was, if it's going to be hard for you to control spending at 3% per year, given the pressures that you're talking about, but given the various other things that they ostensibly want to do, including possibly some type of marquee tax reduction that one could envision being at the centerpiece of their party platform, you know, increased spending on national security, which one could envision falling out of some of the issues concerning election interference over the past couple of years. The point is, on one hand, it's easy to criticize some of the choices the Trudeau government's made over the past decade or so, but an incoming Conservative government needs to understand that it too will face real constraints, and the type of more ambitious fiscal reform that your question is implicitly getting at is something that I think they need to be cognizant of. And, you know, the question is, you know, do you start to set the stage for that today or not? And, you know, I'll leave that to the political strategists to make the decision. But it's a very long way of saying I agree with your implicit point that the days in which I was in Ottawa, in which the default position was a balanced budget or a slight surplus, just as a natural course of things, is essentially over. We are entering a period where if the government wants to be in balance or wants to be in surplus or wants to free up resources to reallocate them to other priorities, it's going to require really tough choices.
Yeah, I'm gonna go off my script and pursue that a little bit more. First, to put into context, the $20 billion in additional annual spending to bring our military investment up to the 2% threshold, that would be an impressive achievement. We should know that within 3 years, old age security is going to do that no matter what. I've been chatting with, you know, Mr. Anand's office. She's the president of the Treasury Board. I'm saying, you know, you've been tasked, find $15 billion in annual savings. I'm like, it's such an unpleasant task, because you find $15 billion in 15 places, and I'll give you one which is going to swamp it, and there's going to be a, like, you're going to net out at zero, and people are going to think you're failing. And so we do have this challenging structural issue, not to mention the other pressures. And so I was going to go pursue a conversation, and time permitting, I might come back to some of the provocative work that you and others have been writing about in the Hub about how we trim some of the spending on things like old age security. But I think you're getting to an even more profound issue, which is, how do we invite Canadians to start talking more about taxes? And, you know, death and taxes, you know, the joke goes is like, you know, the two things in life that are inevitable. I find these days that if you talk publicly about taxes, you're likely to invite people to send you nasty notes wishing you were dead. And there's a kind of vitriol that has come around the theme of just talking about taxes. And dare I say, I think the right in Canadian politics has done more to kind of villainize taxation often than other parts of our political spectrum. And so the hub of all places is actually inviting us to have, to use your word, an adult or mature conversation. Tell me about your experience of trying to do that. What's motivating, and what are your tactics to do it well, so you like set aside the silly vitriol and get to the substance and the seriousness?
Yeah. You know, it seems to me one of the major impediments, Paul, to persuading people that they ought to be prepared to accept higher levels of taxation is that governments in Canada need to demonstrate the kind of state capacity to deliver on the ambitions that really seem at the heart of Mr. Trudeau's politics or Mr. Biden's politics in the United States, or this kind of broader progressive moment we seem to be living in, that I think there have been a series of cases in the past several years which have, I think, reasonably caused people to question our level of state capacity. One thing I've been saying recently, that I think because of aging demographics, because of climate change, because of geopolitics, our future debates will be less about the size of government than they were, say, in the 1980s and 90s. You know, maybe conservatives are able to reduce government by a couple percentage points of shared GDP or something on the margins. I don't know. Probably not. I actually think, given the various demands that are inherently kind of built in to our political economy over the coming decades, the focus ought to be less on the size of government and more about the quality of government. And that's, and I would argue to your work, also the kind of composition of government spending. And, you know, that sort of shifts the conversation away from a left-right divide and creates all sorts of new potential coalitions, including the work that you guys are doing. So I don't like paying taxes as much as anyone, and I especially don't like paying taxes when I see instances of inefficiency or whatever. Like, I, you know, just to be kind of personal for a moment, my wife and I are reasonably compensated, but we have a lot of demands on our household budget. And, you know, that's before we even start to think about saving for our child's our retirement and our children's
education.
And so there is something kind of zero sum, right? And so when our money goes to Ottawa and then we see it being either allocated in cases where it's really not being maximized, I, you know, think for instance, some of the work that you've done on the superfluousness of, say, the age credit or the pension income credit, where we're spending billions of dollars a year. I mean, the age credit's a really objectionable one because, from what I can tell, the only real eligibility criteria is that you're old. You know, it's like, here, you're old. Here's a tax break.
That's exactly right.
So there's those instances where there's just sort of a misallocation of scarce resources. And then there's the kind of more spectacular cases where money is actually wasted or even possibly misused. So that's a very long way of saying, I think the first order of business to kind of establish in the minds of Canadians that they ought to be prepared to think about, in a zero-sum world, more of the resources going to government, is that governments need to be able to demonstrate that they're using those resources efficiently and effectively.
Fair enough. And so I would say we... You know, someone says, hey, Paul, I hear you talking about taxes, but couldn't we just, you know, make our governments more efficient in their use of their dollars and their use of personnel? Okay, that's part of an answer. Or somebody say, Paul, we don't really need to talk that much about taxes. What we need to talk about is productivity. Like, we really need to start getting our economy being more productive, and that will, of its own accord, generate more revenue. And I've written about that, so you can get me nodding in that regard. Or someone might say, you know, well, we could rationalize some spending on some of the big ticket items like old age security. And I think there's room to play on that space too. And some might even say, hey, we need to talk taxes, but not my taxes. Like, just those people making $10 million or more over there. Like, Jagmeet Singh, doesn't he have a plan? And I mean, Jagmeet Singh's plan, by his party's own numbers, won't raise, you know, a fraction of the amount by which old age security again will go up.
Yes.
And so I think that there are a whole bunch of ways that we can try and dodge the conversation. But eventually we're going to need to grapple with it again. Like, we have a revenue resiliency problem. And so it's just such a challenging time with our now having 20% of the population at the most expensive moment of its lives when consuming taxpayer-funded surveys. It's just, no matter how much you want to try and rein something in, there's just like this powerful momentum there to keep it at its current size, if not actually considerably larger. And so I got the sense that that's part of the reckoning that you're inviting amongst the Hub readers.
Yeah, I am. Although, you know, now I'm reflecting my own kind of political preferences.
Please do.
I would be prepared to live with a less ambitious state. I think there are a whole host of areas where state intervention is distortionary and inefficient, and for which the kind of costs aren't matched by accompanying benefits. But you're probably right. At some level, you can only go so far, and that may necessitate hard conversations about revenue enhancement. You know, there's been a longstanding view in economic circles that it was a mistake by the Harper government to lower the federal GST. You know, I think it represents something, what, like $16 billion in revenue. So if you had that, that would solve, you know, ostensibly a lot of problems. But I turn it to you because I think I've inadvertently, Paul, directed our conversation towards this like big structural fiscal question, which is, how do we pay for the stuff that we're asking of government? But, you know, what you do, and one of the reasons I've been so drawn to your work, including this podcast, is that you add another layer. You say, okay, it's not just how we're going to kind of pay for it as it's currently composed, but is there an imbalance in the composition of public spending itself? You know, even if you weren't inclined to try to lower overall spending in net terms, we ought to be thinking more critically about the age distribution. So in that sense, how do you see these two conversations? Like, how do they, at some point, when and how do they ultimately intersect?
Yeah, that's a great question. We have two challenges facing us right now. We have created our biggest public policies in an era when not only was biological vulnerability concentrated amongst older folks, so was economic vulnerability. And the institutions then got a lot of momentum and they keep directing money there. And so spending is consistent with actually now what has become outdated. Economic vulnerability doesn't disproportionately exist amongst an older population. They have really the lowest levels of low income, according to LICO and the Market Basket Measure. They have the most amounts of wealth. They have the most secure housing. Yes, they have biological frailty. That's a reality of the human experience. But we need to recognize it's two different kinds of vulnerability. That's one challenge we're facing, and regrettably, it comes on the heels of a second challenge, and the second one is even more thorny to unpack. And that is when we created these big services to address economic vulnerability later in the lives, we had the baby boomers who were young. There were seven of them for every retiree, and government's like, hey, this isn't so hard to do. Let's get, you know, a small amount of taxes from each of these seven folks. Let's share the load easily amongst everybody, and that'll contribute to every retiree. But it didn't take long for smart people or even, you know, it didn't take long for any kind of person to say the math is not going to hold on. And we will know that eventually, we call them a boom. They're a big group for a reason. And when they hit retirement, there will then be only three working age people for every retiree. And so the conversation is challenging here. Not only do we have people not recognizing how much of our spending happens later in the life course for a group that's not necessarily economically vulnerable, we have to have a hard conversation with my mom, my parents, my in-laws, my aunts and uncles, and say, back in the day, the government set rules for taxes that didn't actually collect enough from you to cover what you reasonably now expect to be using. And how do we make up for that failed planning decades ago? That is the challenge that Mr. Polyev will face if he becomes prime minister or whoever wins after the next election. That is the problem that Doug Ford's facing. That is the problem that David Eby's facing and every premier is facing. And so how do you start that conversation with people who we love? Because you can't say it's your fault. They paid according to the rules of the day. The rules of the day were just stacked in their favor and against their kids and grandchildren. And we're now trying to figure out how to wrestle with that.
Yeah, well said. We've got a great encapsulation of the work that you've been doing over the years at Generation Squeezed. Well done, Paul. I would add, though, one other layer of complexity.
Please.
Which is, we have a basic kind of policymaking principle of fairness. And I don't mean equity or equality in the conventional sense. I mean that we try to protect people from instances when they've reasonably made life choices based on a particular set of rules of the game. And instances when those rules of the game change, we have, generally speaking, it's not a non-negotiable rule, but generally sought to protect them against those changes. You know, let me go from the abstract to the concrete. You know, one of the more radical ideas that you've been associated with, for which I have a lot of sympathy, and that is revisiting the capital gains exemption on primary residence. Like, on one hand, I think, yeah, that's a self-evident area for reform. On the other hand, your parents or your in-laws or my parents or whomever have made a series of choices about retirement savings and so on that they would have made differently, presumably, if that policy was not in place. And so if you got a prime minister who bought into the Kershaw vision and you started to shock the system in the name of trying to solve for that planning failure that you mentioned, you know, to what extent would that principle loom over your thinking or over on your mind, rightly over the thinking of the prime minister?
Yeah.
And I should say that's not a leading question. It's a genuine one because I think it is a kind of inherent challenge, I think, for policymakers as they think about trying to, you know, sort of gouge some of these sacred cows.
Well, first, as a minor tangent, I think it is so interesting how my work is associated with the idea that we should now have capital gains taxation on principal residence. Actually, that's not what we argue. We say that, you know, we created a big problem by exempting principal residences from capital gains taxation half a century ago. But actually, I don't think you can fix it by ending that policy now. We would propose progressivity on annual property taxation. But nevertheless, there's this whole narrative out there that that is actually what we think about. And I just raise that because I ran into a colleague from the Canadian Taxpayers Federation the other day in the budget lockup in BC, and I joked with him, I think that his organization raises more money misrepresenting the work we do than our organization is to raise by actually representing the work accurately. Anyhow, setting that aside, you asked this profound question. You say, Paul, you're telling us that the rules of the game back in the day when boomers were young and they played by those rules, but they were stacked against their kids and grandchildren. And now you want to change those rules. But the moment you change rules on which people have been counting for all of their lives, you know, that's a little bit unfair too, because they've been organizing according to those rules. And so when you change rules, you think you like got to protect people from the consequences of that change. And I guess I would say we have to do a little bit of both. There is absolutely no doubt that a younger demographic has major skin in the game. They are already contributing more in taxes towards old age insecurity and medical care for their parents and grandparents than was asked of boomers when they were young. And that's going to carry on and we'll not be able to avoid it. So while we ask them to adapt and accept the fact that the rules of the game back in the day weren't in their favor, is it not necessarily doable to say, But parents and grandparents who we love, I don't think that's what you want for your kids and grandparents. Can you meet them part way? And I think I would still be encouraging any prime minister to be saying, this is the conversation you need to start. We got to be inviting an older demographic to meet their kids and grandchildren part way and expecting a younger demographic to do the same so that we actually get the intergenerational solidarity that we want around our family tables and actually would be so beautiful to see in politics.
That's a great answer. I think there's something to that. I do think that sometimes the intergenerational conversation underestimates the extent to which parents are invested in the success of their children and would be prepared to make some trade-offs to support them. I will also say that these questions about protecting populations from policy change was absolutely top of mind when the Harper government enacted the gradual increase to the old age security eligibility age from 65 to 67. We thought a lot about trying to ensure that the rules of the game were adjusted, but not in a way that was sort of inherently unfair for people who wouldn't have enough time to adjust, say, their private savings in order to account for delay in their old age security. And so I guess it is a long way of saying, as you think a bit about trying to solve for the problem that you so ably identified, could you establish something of a principle-based framework to kind of ensure that these changes can be effectuated without creating real hardship for people? Because, you know, just as parents are invested in the success of their children, even children don't want to see their parents suddenly experience like a drop in their household income or their household living standards because
absolutely
something that they were counting on is no longer available to them.
I do take heart in the fact that something historic happened in the BC budget that was tabled in 2024, where in its strategic plan, the government embraced the idea of generational fairness. It's only a 6-page strategic plan. The first couple of pages, they're like lifting text almost from a Gen Squeeze website. It's beautiful. And they talk about determination to make BC work for all generations, investing in well-being from the early years onwards. You're someone who's worked at the highest office in the land. Do you think it's significant when the framework, even if just in words that governments articulate, start to embrace that intergenerational lens more overtly, more publicly?
Yeah, I think so. I'm open to being corrected, but BC's population tilts older than the national average, right?
It does, yeah.
So it is interesting to me that of all provinces, we're seeing the BC government sort of lead on this front. Part of it, I think, reflects the changing political landscape. Millennials now outnumber baby boomers for the first time since, I think, 1958. The baby boomers are no longer the country's largest population group. I think that's bound to have kind of political consequences, both in terms of the incentives of politicians being responsive to millennial or Gen Z voters, but also the extent to which we increasingly see millennials and Gen Z themselves represented in our politics. I know we have to wrap up soon. Do you mind if I take this opportunity, Paul, to kind of spitball a policy idea that I've had to try to recognize the unique challenges that younger Canadians are facing? You probably know that we presently have a lifetime capital gains exemption of something like $800,000. It's indexed, so I don't know the precise number it is today, but I think last year it was $800,000. I've been thinking about matching that with something like a lifetime basic personal exemption in the income tax system to effectively say the first, say, $250,000 that an individual earns is shielded from taxation, because individuals in those circumstances are paying off student loans or saving for a home or possibly saving to start a business or start a family or whatever, and that we have a kind of collective interest in this formative period from the transition from education into the workforce, and we're going to, you know, effectively fulfill that collective interest in the form of this lifetime tax shield. I think it meets the progressivity test in the sense that high income earners would exhaust the exemption sooner than lower income earners for whom it would be available to them for a longer period of time, but it wouldn't treat one less generously than the other. I concede that there would probably be some big transitional considerations, but I think this would be a kind of, in theory anyway, I'm open to practical objections, a kind of powerful way for us to collectively say we have an interest in young Canadians succeeding, and this is one means by which we're going to use the power of government policy to try to make it a little easier for them. Mm-hmm. What's your kind of immediate reaction to that, Paul?
Yeah, my immediate reaction is to lean in and want to lend it support at a theoretical level. I have to think carefully about like some of the implementation challenges to which you refer. And what I like about it is it starts to model, you know, the opposite of the joke that I made earlier. Like, we're talking taxes and you're not, you know, we're not sending death threats to one another and saying, you know, just silly vitriolic things. We're actually saying we could make a better tax system. And I think the conversation about sort of a broader tax shelter for income earlier in people's lives is consistent with how economic vulnerability has shifted towards younger folks. It then begs the question, though, we do have this revenue resiliency challenge. And so how are we going to compensate for it? And so that's why at Gen Squeeze, we're often talking about like the tax shift. And, you know, I was joking earlier, we actually don't talk about getting rid of the exemption on taxing principal residences from their capital gains. But we do propose, you know, reducing taxes on income, especially for middle and lower earners. Maybe your first $250K earned would be the right thing to do. And then you compensate for that. And we're going to capture more taxes from high value homes. Like mine's now 2.4 million. I have a million into it. So that's like 1.4 million of just purely tax sheltered wealth windfall. And I think if we had a more effective tax system that wanted to drive productivity, not to mention fairness, you would say, hey, that wealth windfall in your home pile is something you could contribute back. And that would take pressure off raising taxes on income in the kind of way that, you know, perhaps you're giving us the transformative great idea to do.
Yeah, I'm all for trying to make it revenue neutral. I know you've written in the past about eliminating the age credit, the pension income credit. There are a lot of provisions that I think could be eliminated and those resources redeployed to something like this. I've been thinking a lot about the challenges facing people in this sort of formative period. And one of the things that motivates me, and this may be a reflection of my politics, and you know, I recognize if this isn't something that motivates all of your listeners, mm-hmm. but I am, in part maybe because I'm a father of young kids at age 41, so I'm part of the cohort of delayed family formation. I think that is a problem. You know, there's evidence by a demographer at McGill University named Lyman Stone that Canadian women are having on average about 0.5 kids fewer than they say they want. So this isn't a matter of kind of imposing expectations on fertility. It's saying that there are some factors standing in the way of women realizing their fertility goals. And, you know, when you dig a bit deeper, it's things like job precarity, inadequate housing, student debt, mm-hmm. you know, all of those sorts of things which are standing in the way. And so in that sense, if we could create some real relief for people in this formative period, it would fundamentally try to rebalance the distribution of public resources along age-based lines and recognize that the status quo tilts in the direction of older Canadians and then effectively say, you know what, we think that young Canadians deserve dedication of some scarce resources to meet their unique needs in this period of their life where saving for a home, having a family, these are types of things that have long-run consequences for them and for the rest of us, which is why I think you can kind of justify, you know, having this kind of collective interest in freeing up their resources to better themselves and establish themselves.
Mm-hmm. It's interesting, in the recent BC budget, one of the talking points that got a lot of attention was the fact that BC's joined a couple of other provinces in providing access to now publicly subsidized IVF to help people with their fertility problems. And I think some people anticipated that I was going to be really keen on like speaking positively about that. And I said, you know, if you really wanted to support people's fertility, you wouldn't try and fix it via medical care. You would be recognizing that the data show it is the affordability challenges that have shifted towards younger people that are giving rise to their delaying starting their families. And then BC has the highest average age of birthing, which then means BC has the highest percentage of cesarean procedures, you know, and then I don't know the data on this, but likely we're then probably having relatively high rates of people needing IVF to help them, you know, once they've got a bit of a financial foundation to need support with their fertility. And that's just relying too much on spending on medical care to fix problems that really are about the determinants of health and well-being and family yes. happiness, et cetera.
Yeah. Well said. Yeah. I think that's spot on. And so if I was advising Pierre Poilievre, I'm not, but you know, it's self-evident that the Conservatives have had success in recent months with younger voters. The party now leads for the first time, and I think in its history, amongst 18 to 39-year-old voters, in part because the Poilievre and the Conservatives have brought expression to some of the issues that we've been talking about, particularly on housing. And that's why I'm kind of drawn to something more radical, like this lifetime basic personal income tax exemption. It's the type of thing that would have practical benefits for people, but as much it would have kind of powerful symbolic ones.
You know, Sean, when you think about this, you know, what you're proposing is a big radical idea. I'm not sure how radical it actually is. You know, it's not that large an amount of income to exempt early in one's life. And it makes me think about sort of this overarching mission Jen Squeeze is on right now. We're not just asking governments to implement specific policy changes on housing or $10 a day childcare or improving medical care, et cetera. We're actually saying bake into the machinery of government an intergenerational lens. We take hope from the fact that the BC government is starting to do that in its strategic plan. Right now, we have an ask of the federal government, launch a federal task force on intergenerational fairness. And I wonder, you know, if we'd been coming to you when you were a senior policy advisor in the PMO and saying, hey, how do we embed this lens more into the machinery of government? Do you have any advice for us?
You said a couple of different things there. You talked about a task force. You also talked about a lens, Paul. I think the lens might ultimately have more durable upside. The extent to which it sort of forces policymakers to confront the intergenerational consequences of their policy choices. A task force is good. It has the immediate effect of drawing attention to issues. But when I was in Ottawa, we added in response to demands from the small business sector, something called the small business lens, which was thereafter embedded into policy decision-making documents, including what are called memoranda to cabinet, the materials that cabinet ministers use to make judgments. And so in theory, as you were going through those materials, including the proposal and the estimated cost and the estimated benefits and so on, at some point, you had to confront the question, how does this affect the small business sector, either positively or negatively or neutrally? You know, I don't want to overstate things. I don't think in practice that fundamentally reshaped cabinet decision-making. But I can't help but think that over time, it starts to socialize people a bit to ask that question. And in that sense, I think making the case that memorandum to cabinet account for intergenerational effects of different policy choices, the budget materials that the Minister of Finance uses to ultimately populate the budget with individual spending measures, applying an intergenerational lens to those choices could be interesting. Even having the Parliamentary Budget Office produce an annual analysis of overall spending and its intergenerational bias. You know, the types of things that overnight are not going to change policymaking, but the extent to which they sort of start to tilt the conversation and the incentives in favor of being mindful of intergenerational effects of policy choices, I think they're the kind of things that can ultimately make a difference on the margins.
Those are really useful suggestions. To some degree, we've been playing with the GBA plus, the gender-based analysis plus, and early on our efforts were like, add an intergenerational lens to the plus. And progress was made on that front in 2018, 2019. But what we had happen is Treasury Board submissions ask, okay, with this new ask of funding, how does it play out for young? How does it play out for old? But what didn't happen is people said, like, okay, we're looking at the intergenerational implications of every new tree we're planting in the federal budget forest. But it didn't have people go and assess, what does the overall forest look like?
Yes.
And that is what we are at Gen Squeeze really trying to push people to do, because I think we've lost the picture of the forest for every, you know, the focus on each new tree people are thinking about planting.
Yeah, well said. And in fact, you know, maybe a good way to kind of connect the dots from our earlier conversation, because that is the fundamental problem, not just facing the intergenerational imbalance in our public spending, but even addressing the broader problem that we started with, which is how much do we want to pay for government and what do we want it to do? One of the things that my former boss, Stephen Harper, used to lament, that through the media and the Canadian public and politicians and stakeholders and others had been kind of socialized over time to only concern themselves with incremental. You know, the budget, for instance, only talks about what new stuff the government is going to do. And it rarely do other governments get credit, or do we fundamentally start with the premise that government's already doing a lot of stuff? And so I think you're precisely right to sort of to ask that question, like, what is the baseline? And then thereafter, how do we measure up against that baseline? Is it moving in a less intergenerationally imbalanced direction or a more intergenerationally imbalanced direction? I think there's a ton of insight there, Paul. And you know, if you can, again, establish that starting point, then hopefully you can kind of start to nudge policymakers in a direction where they would actually be sort of boastful.
Mm-hmm.
Could we get to a place where politicians could say, you know, this budget actually helps to move closer to the direction of intergenerational balance, as opposed to the negative way of thinking about it, which is that we're, you know, effectively taking stuff away from your mom and mother-in-law. I applaud what you're doing and hope it works out, because I do think that that's the kind of work you need to do to begin to sort of shift the policymaking mindset.
Mm-hmm. The time together has flown by. We could keep chatting and chatting and chatting and take more and more of your time. But I do want to say, let's wrap up now, my friend, and to wish you ongoing success with the journalistic leadership you're providing at The Hub, and a sincere appreciation for modeling a depth of political discourse across intellectual and ideological divides that models the kind of discourse we need to see more and more in Canadian politics and in our Canadian public. And so thank you for all of that.
It's very kind. It's been a pleasure. I look forward to being back on the show sooner rather than later.
Well, then we will make that happen. Take good care.
Thanks so much for listening. And we hope you'll watch for our analysis of the federal budget next week. You can find our commentary on our website, gensqueeze.ca, and in Paul's column in the Globe and Mail. Also, if you find yourself with any burning budget questions, please join us for our office hours on our Substack chat, April 19th from noon to 3 p.m. Pacific time.